House Rural Communities Land Use and Water Committee. Thanks for being here today. Our chair, Representative Clem, is going to be away from the committee today, and as I understand it, probably Tuesday on some family business. So we will persevere and do the best we can in his absence. To explain a little bit about how we'll be operating while he's gone, it's unlikely that we'll try to move anything out of committee during his absence. And so, and that's the case with the first two items on our work session agenda today, HB 2463. We had questions from committee members that of the Department of State Lands that it's to my knowledge, and since Representative McLean is not here at the moment, I don't believe have been resolved quite yet. So we are going to carry that over, I think, onto our next committee meeting.
So move to carry it over. You just say we're carrying over.
So we're carrying House Bill 2463 over onto our next agenda, which will be next Tuesday, February 17th.
Yes, 17th.
As a work session was also scheduled for House Bill 2148, at the request of the sponsors, we're pulling that off the agenda today, and it is not being carried over onto the agenda for the 17th, but may come back onto our agenda, and if it does so, it'll have the typical 72 hours of notice. So we'll not be dealing with that today. So HB 2148 is carried over. Oh, it's taken off it.
Yeah.
So again, HB 2148 is taken off the agenda indefinitely. What we do have time for today, and I'm going to open a work session on, is HB 2445, which allows the Director of Agriculture and the State Department of Agriculture to choose a method for giving notice regarding quarantines in control areas and related rules. We had a public hearing on this in a previous committee meeting. It's my preference to continue this to our next regularly scheduled meeting, but I wanted to open it up to committee members if there's any need for discussion or you've learned anything in the interim.
I guess I have a comment.
Vice Chair Post.
Chair Helm, first of all, you can go ahead and bang that gavel a little louder. I think you should take advantage of this and just let her rip. That's what I'm talking about. We had a great discussion the other day with the people that testified on this, and I got some questions answered that I had about the rural newspapers, which I know was one of Representative McLean's concerns, was the rural areas, the newspapers versus electronic and all that. But I just, again, I just feel out of respect for Representative Clem that perhaps we should carry it over.
Very good. Any further comment from the committee? Okay. Very good. We'll carry over HB 2445 to our next regularly scheduled meeting on February 17th. How's that? Good?
That was good.
All right. Next on our agenda for today is an informational session from our representatives from the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Welcome. Please come forward.
Thank you. I will attempt to both work the electronics and speak to you. I think I ended up with more than I had to say, but first wanted to say thank you to Vice Chair Helm, Vice Chair Post, and members of the committee for having us here today. My name is Carrie McLaren. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I understand, though I haven't been present for all of them, that you've been hearing some agency overviews both about what their departments are structured a little bit like, as well as the program and programs and services that are delivered. I will attempt to do the same. I will say that I tend to talk quickly and try to pack in more information. So if any of you look quizzical, I'll try to slow down and meter myself better. So as I said, our goal is to talk a little bit about the framework of the land use planning program, how we deliver it, touch upon a few measures of how we think the program's doing. If I have any time left, to talk about a few key policy areas, and then certainly we'll reserve time for any questions that, that you may have. The state's land use planning program was formulated through Senate Bill 100 and 101 in 1973, and those really provide the foundation for our land use planning program. The policies that I have up on the screen here are but a few that really provide the structure and the architecture for our program. But if you look through the words, I think some key phrases really are focusing on coordination between cities and counties and at the state and regional level. Comprehensive land use planning that addresses both rural and urban needs, and that also integrates economic development, environmental protection, housing, transportation, energy conservation, agriculture, timber, schools, institutional needs. The list really go on. And I think really the best way of thinking about it, if you're a more visual person, is by the diagram up here, really showing land use planning as being the forum to collect, plan, and reconcile what are sometimes competing needs. I will say I sometimes pause and say I'm not always certain that all needs are competing, and that indeed our charge may be to maximize all of those goals to the greatest extent possible. So the state framework in terms of our department organization, as I said, the statewide land use planning program was created by Senate Bill 100 and 101 in 1973. It included the creation of the Land Conservation and Development Commission, as well as the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Our commission is formulated from seven non-paid citizen members that are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. They really serve as the policy arm of the land use planning program. They adopted the original statewide planning goals in the 1970s, and they have amended them and implemented them in the years to follow. And we certainly have seen a number of amendments to the content, not the names of the goals, but certainly to the content of the goals and how they're implemented. I would note that our commission represents regions of the state. So by statute, we have five regions, including the coast, Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, Willamette Valley, and the Tri-County metro area that are required to be represented on our commission. We are also required to have a current and former elected, current or former elected city official, and a current elected county official. So we have Commissioner Lamb, who I think is approximately in the middle, who was is a prior counselor from the City of Talent. And we just recently had joined our commission, Commissioner Melissa Cribbins from Coos County. There also is a focus on having some breadth of balance and expertise on policy issues, and so we have members of our commission who have at least some experience in agriculture development and land use planning. The primary purpose for the commission and for the department is to review local plans and updates related to periodic review, which is the process by which local communities update their comprehensive plans, and also to review decisions relating to urban growth boundary expansions. The smaller or more episodic individual amendments are reviewed if they are appealed by the Land Use Board of Appeals. Our program is one that I would highlight has this state framework, but is really implemented, and I'll talk about a little bit later, at the local level by the cities and counties, and in some cases special districts. A quick slide, we have staff located around the state. We have done this traditionally and historically, although the locations have changed over time. Right now, these locations are for the most part commensurate with where the regional solutions centers are, and indeed our staff is one of the five state agencies that comprise the regional solutions teams. In addition to reviewing policy amendments, comprehensive plan updates, urban growth boundary amendments, our department performs two, I think, very critical functions, both providing technical assistance to local communities as they seek to update their plans and address new and emerging community needs, and secondly, to provide some grant funding for communities to be able to do that work on their own. This graphic up here illustrates the jurisdictions that received grants from us in this current biennium that we are now bringing to a close. We have three sources of funds that comprise our grant programs. One is from the general fund grant program. The second is from a joint program that we have with the Oregon Department of Transportation, which is called our Transportation and Growth Management Program, seeking to link transportation planning with land use planning to maximize those areas. And then finally, federal funds through the Oregon Coastal Management Program. I am not going to run through each one of the 19 statewide land use planning goals, but have them up here on the screen to sort of show the breadth of issues again that our department and our commission are charged with addressing in partnership with cities and counties and local communities. They range from goal one, citizen involvement in major planning decisions so that we are assuring that we're planning for the people in those communities. A second grouping around natural resource goals, goals three and four, and to some extent five, really that are looking to preserve the land base for our farm and forest land and our industries that today still represent the second and third largest economic sectors for the state. The next clumping of goals that I would do are goals 9 through 12, as well as goal 14, which really are focused on assuring that that there is land available for jobs and housing, and that public facilities are planned for, efficient, and economical. And then last, a clump of goals 5 through 19. And they're interesting, actually, to sort because they really were part of what provided some impetus for the land use planning program in its inception. And that's protection of the Willamette Greenway, and then also goals relating to unique coastal resources. So again, going back to this state-local framework and the partnership and connection, cities and counties are the entities that adopt local land use plans and make land use policy. Those are the usually referred to as the comprehensive plans. And in the context of what kind of review or action that is, that's typically the nomenclature is to call it a legislative action. The second set of activities around surround adopting regulations that are consistent with the statewide land use planning goals, and that's really where we're talking about zoning and development codes. And finally, approving and denying local land use decisions or applications and permits. And that's when we get more into the quasi-judicial arena for local governments. But I think the important thing it really is to say is that our statewide land use planning program provides a framework and goals that communities are required to be consistent with, but that's actually it's actually built up from local plans, and that's where the permitting activity occurs. I should also highlight that this at the state level, we have a bit of a horizontal coordination as well. Our statewide land use planning program touches on many other state agencies. This is a list of state agencies with whom we have actual state agency coordination programs to assure that state agency actions are indeed consistent with both the statewide land use planning program and also the local local plans and codes. So now, next phase, I'll talk a little bit about our mission or goals, strategic plan for the department. We really have a three-part component to our mission. One is to help local governments and citizens plan for their future, for what their current needs are and for their future needs. The second is to foster sustainable and vibrant communities, and we define those to be communities where there are jobs, where there's safe and desirable housing, access to good jobs, safe and accessible transportation choices, parks, schools, all the pieces that we think of as the building blocks of our community. And then also to protect our natural resources legacy, and as I said at the outset, for both economic and environmental purposes. We do this work with 242 cities and 36 counties. Really requires in many cases that we be problem solvers to help communities address issues in their region. Some of those concern population growth. For other communities, it's the development pressures on farm and forest land and conversion, economic decline in both rural areas as well as urban areas of our state, climate change and citizen involvement. I think I did hear Director Kopa in part of her remarks refer to the agriculture as being very diverse in the state, and I would say our state as a whole is quite diverse, both in terms of the communities, the landscapes, the economic resources, the concerns of those communities. I want to talk about really three areas that our program works most predominantly in. The first is with respect to forest land protection, and I would phrase this, well, why in part are we working to protect the forest land base? We certainly have seen in this state the economy related to timber products decline, and unfortunately it also seems to be a national trend. It is somewhat tied up, or more than somewhat tied up, in federal forest policies. But at the end of the day, Oregon remains the leading producer of timber in the lower United States, and jobs in the forest products industry are still one of the leading traded sector industries. So we ask ourselves, well, how are we doing? If it's important to protect it, what are our results on the ground? And if we compare ourselves to our neighbor, Washington State, most of the farm and forest lands that we had in that use in 1987 remain in those uses today. In contrast, in Washington State, recent studies show about 30,000 acres of forest land that are lost to conversion in Washington every year. So that gives a comparator to how we're doing. There certainly are challenges in this arena. Development pressure for houses, fire, breakup of vertically integrated forest products industries I referred to, federal forest policy. By no means is it an area without challenge, but an area where we are having some on-the-ground success. Farmland protection, again, our primary charge here is to protect that land base that is credited with a $22 billion industry, 15% of all economic activity in the state, and one out of every 10 jobs in the state. So it provides an important function, certainly for our rural areas, but also for our more urban areas, as that's where some of the food processing and whatnot occurs. So this is an area where I think we have a connection between the urban and rural areas of our state importance. Again, as I related previously, we see the majority of our farmland still being in production today. We see increasing improvements after 1984, when all the county comprehensive plans were actually adopted. And if we compare ourselves to neighboring states, again, our trend line is much less conversion of agricultural land as compared to Idaho, California, and Washington, as well as nationally. There are a number of issues related to agriculture. Director Kopa spoke to a lot of them. Where we intersect mostly is in that conversion issue, whether it's in permitting non-farm uses in agricultural zones or whether it is conversion to either rural residential, rural industrial, or urban growth boundary uses. Final area that I will talk about some is our urban growth boundary policies. They really are produced as a tool to direct and plan for growth. We seek outcomes both in terms of land efficiency and lower cost of infrastructure. This is an area where I will identify that while we've seen, and certainly as we compare ourselves nationally, quite a bit of good on-the-ground results, and I'll hit on a couple of them, it is an area where we have identified that the process needs improvement. And for those of you who recall the 2013 legislative session, we proposed with a large group of stakeholders some streamlining to our urban growth boundary amendment process that was passed unanimously by both houses and signed into law as House Bill 2254. Our department is currently working on rulemaking there, and that rulemaking will go into effect on January 1st of 2016. So here's an area where I think we've certainly identified good on the ground results, but some areas where we needed some process improvement. The other related process improvement that I will refer to is House Bill 2253, again passed unanimously in the 2013 legislative session, and that called upon and funded the Portland State's Center for Population Research to do routine and periodic updates to population forecasts so that communities, counties, and cities had the numbers that they needed to know to base their future forecast for land use planning. Regrettably, many communities didn't even have one that was coordinated or had ones that were woefully out of date. This provides the funding for that key component of community planning. Just very quickly, some comparative slides about how Oregon does compared to our neighboring western states. As you can see, we generally have been growing more efficiently than other western states. It has impacts for us in terms of the cost of growth. And this slide refers to some studies that were done by the Brookings Institution about what levels of density and the ability for communities to both finance, both in terms of the capital improvements to build it in the first place and maintenance costs with respect to those public services. In Oregon, if we look at a period from 1982 to 1997, the U.S. grew by 17%, while Oregon's population actually outpaced that at 20%. During that same time, the amount of urbanized land in the nation increased by 47%, while in Oregon it only expanded by 3%. It's showing that we both were using that land that had already been pre-planned inside of urban growth boundaries to accommodate some of that growth, as well as efficiently expanding our boundaries. And Chair Helm, I realize I was not given a time limit. So if there's a point at which I need to stop, I'm at a conclusion slide. I can continue and I can answer some more questions. But I want to be mindful of your agenda as well. So I'll look to you for some guidance after I just make a couple of concluding remarks here, if I may.
Thank you. You've been going about 15 minutes. I think you got a few more minutes
okay.
to go for sure.
Thank you. So as I said, conclusions, what do we derive from the work that we've been doing? Our programs are achieving outcomes and objectives that meet our statewide land use planning goals. We're absorbing population growth using less land and using less land than neighboring states. And we think this is important because it results also in lower public facility and transportation costs over time. On that point, there was another a comparative study of states done by the Lincoln Land Institute. And just as but one example, they compared transportation and as compared to seven other states, Oregon had the smallest increase in hours of congestion and delay. And that's important because if you also look at the other states that were implementing land use growth management programs, they were actually after the implementation of those programs also seeing a decrease in their congestion and delay. We are conserving farm and forest lands for the agricultural and forest products industries as well as for environmental values in the state. At the core of our mission, we believe that we can work to enhance urban and rural communities, again, in partnership with those communities, protect the resource base, and promote citizen involvement. I would say one of the changes, it was certainly there at the conception, but the outcomes are increasingly reflecting regional solutions with diverse partnerships. So needing to bring, whether it's community colleges to the table for economic development, community development activities, working with the business community, with agricultural business interests, as well as local governments. A quick slide to just highlight some of our priorities and accomplishments. I think you would see if you collect them both at the top and the bottom of the slide, some increased focus from our department on planning for natural hazards, including tsunamis, but also other coastal erosion plans, such as we worked on in the city of Neskowin. I talked a little bit about population forecasting and our urban growth boundary streamlining. Really working with regional solutions centers increasingly on economic development planning. And one of them that we would highlight is a food hub that consists of a processing, cold storage, and distribution facility and farm stand in southern Oregon that can be used not only by the farm that originally conceived it, but neighboring farms, enabling some of those businesses to grow. We also, in this last year, have worked internally on a strategic plan to help guide our department and really identifying what are our key objectives over the next 8 years, so that we're sure that we're aligning both staff resources, grant funding, other technical assistance that we provide to local governments. There are our five strategic goals relate to conserving Oregon's natural resources. Again, that goes back to our work on farm and forest land protection and primarily coastal resources. Also coastal resources. Two, promoting sustainable, vibrant communities. Within that is really community development, economic development, transportation planning, and transportation choices, assuring that we have an adequate and affordable and safe housing supply for our communities. Again, we don't provide those directly, but we do work with local governments to provide the technical assistance to assure that their land use codes and their land use plans accommodate those needs. Engaging the public and stakeholders in Oregon's land use planning program, providing timely and dynamic leadership to support local and regional problem solving. And this is one that I will highlight. I think we have an increased opportunity, particularly through use of aggregate statewide data to help local communities do their planning. And so we have been working within the department to improve our GIS services, how we're able to push out those services so that we both can evaluate how we're doing, but also push out the data that we have to communities where they can use it in their planning processes. And finally, I think a goal that we certainly need to have and should continue to have, delivering services that are efficient, outcome-based, and professional. So with that, I will close. I would say that these long-term strategic goals by no means replace our statewide planning goals, but we actually seek to collapse those so that we can be more directive and efficient in our delivery to local communities. With that, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? So I can get off easy today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for coming. Appreciate it. At this point in the hearing, I'm going to open up a public hearing all at the same time on four bills and run through them. We're going to change the order slightly so that we can accommodate some of our elected officials and folks that have traveled a distance to get here. HB 2633 was identified as being third, I think, on our schedule. I'm going to move it to the next item. In doing so, I note that Representative Leininger is here and Representative Boone. I'll give you the choice of either testifying at the dais or joining us up here, if you'd like. Okay, so please come up. And Richard Whitman, if you'd like to join them on the first panel, I think that would be useful.
We'll let him be lucky, Pierre.
So before you start, I'm going to finish my introduction of the bills. Subsequent to the public hearing on HB 2633, we'll hear about and have a public hearing on HB 2456, HB 2457, and HB 2719. And I'm opening a public hearing on all four bills at this time. So, representatives and guests, please go right ahead as you see fit.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Helm, and members of the committee. We're really happy to be here today. This is an important bill, and it's a bill that it matters to me from personal experience. I grew up in Southern Oregon on the outskirts of Ashland, and we lived on a winding dirt road surrounded by orchards and dry grass. And I remember once when I was around seven, it was around August, and there was a wildfire coming up the road on both sides of the orchard. And I remember my mom talking to my brother and me, and there was no other way out from the place where we lived besides going down this one dirt road. And I remember her saying to me, "Ann, you know, if I tell you that we need to do this, I need you guys to jump in the car, and we're going to drive down this hill as fast as we can." And it was a very scary thing, and thankfully everything turned out fine. But the bottom line is there are some real natural hazards in all parts of the state. In the last two fire seasons, we have appropriated, I believe, $60 million roughly in additional funds to fight wildfires as we deal with some extreme drought conditions in parts of our state. The Oso landslide in 2014, as you know, resulted in the deaths of 43 people, and there are some very significant concerns about earthquakes and tsunami risk on the coast, about which a committee of people, including Representative Boone in a leadership role, and Mr. Whitman and others, and Representative Widener, have been doing some important work to help us plan. The key word here is planning. You know, in order to deal well with the natural hazards that we face in Oregon, which include earthquakes, tsunamis, wildfire, landslides, a range of things, some of which are associated with climate change, some of which are associated with the fact that we live in an earthquake zone and near the ocean, we need to be planning well about them, and we have an opportunity to make our planning work even better. There is a existing law, Goal 7 in our land use planning law. It's been applicable to communities for years and years. It has to do with natural hazards and the fact that we need to think about natural hazards when our communities grow and develop. However, Goal 7 does not have any implementing rules, unlike other land use planning goals. So we are bringing forward a bill, House Bill 2633, of which Representative Boone and I are both sponsors, together with you, sir, and Representative Gomberg and some others. Thank you for that. That would direct a Land Conservation and Development Commission to create rules to clarify what communities are supposed to think about when they're thinking about natural hazards. We've worked with a wide range of people on this bill. I was speaking with Representative Widener earlier today about a related bill that he has. This is part of a suite of steps that we're trying to take to be more resilient and prepared in the event of disaster and in dealing with natural hazards. We are in the process of working with the Home Builders Association and the Realtors to address some questions that they've raised. But in general, I think that we are going to be able to get to a place where a broad range of people recognize that this is an important step and can support creating rules and guidance for communities and how we think about natural hazards. And that's what this simple and important bill does. And I will look forward to bringing it back to you later, hopefully for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you, chairs and committee members. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I have to say it's exciting to be before your committee again. The last time I was before land use was when somebody got and stuffed my bill with Measure 49. That was interesting. So,
oh, it's your fault.
Yeah. So I'm here wave the flag for the resilience plan again, and we're still working on that. As Representative Leininger mentioned, the resilience plan came forward in 2011, 130 some odd pages, 170 people on a committee that created it, and an 8-chapter summary. And the summary contained several recommendations that all went to the next phase of implementation, in which you're seeing now this session, some of those recommendations being put in into place. And one of the things that we talked about were natural hazards, and especially in my district and Representative Gomberg's, and then along the coast, the coastal hazards. And Commissioner Mark Labhart was here yesterday. It's too bad we couldn't bring him in today again, but he's been working very hard on this issue. He sits on the Senate Bill 33 task force, but he's the expert, local expert, on some of the natural hazards issues, especially in NESCO and in my old district, but still now in Rep. Gomberg's district. And these are erosion issues, things like that. But we handle them all. I tried to go through the whole list of natural hazards that we have along the coast, and the only one I could come up with was a volcano. I don't think we have those on land. They're under the sea. And so anyway, or asteroids, but that could happen too. So I totally urge you to support all the resilience bills. You'll see them come forth, not as a package altogether, but in different committees. And I welcome any questions from you. I'm not an expert per se, but Just like seafloor mapping, that which is lost on you newbies, but Rep. Gilliam will remember every time people saw me coming down the hall, it was, oh no, here comes the seafloor mapping person. So I am just as dogged in my efforts on this. So I will quit there and answer questions if you have any. Thank you.
Well, we hear from Mr. Whitman, and then we'll take questions for the whole panel one time.
Thank you, Co-Chair Helm. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Whitman. I'm the Natural Resources Advisor for Governor Kitzhaber. The governor is supportive of the idea behind this bill, believes that this issue of risk to our communities, to public safety, is a serious one. We have some existing tools that we have in place now to help address some of those risks. Goal 7 is one of the ones that's been mentioned, but I want to make sure the committee is also aware. For our forest practices program, we also have a program under that program as well to handle landslide risk that exists that was put in place some time ago. There also was an effort in 2010 under then Governor Kulongoski to do a really comprehensive risk assessment statewide and try to tease out what are the key risks and what should we be doing first in terms of addressing those. That risk assessment is in the process of being updated right now, and hopefully will be ready in the next month or so, and is a good supplement to the very good work that the representatives here and others have been doing on the resilience plan. So pulling all those different threads together and trying to work with our local communities to help them identify what are the key risks for their communities and what do they believe they should be doing to address those risks is very important work. The governor's budget does recommend funding in a number of places that are complementary to this effort. In particular, there's a policy option package, a significant one, for the Department of Land Conservation and Development to support this type of work. There are also three policy option packages for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries to support the science work that needs to underpin the planning work that we're talking about with regard to House Bill 2633. And then finally, going from science to planning to response, if you will, the Oregon Office of Emergency Management also has an important role to play here in putting an overall program together. So the governor's committed to helping work on this bill, is supportive of the concept behind it. I think in particular we want to make sure we bring in some of our local government representatives on this, because they have been doing work in this area that I think we, the state, can learn from and benefit from in terms of providing examples to other communities. So we look forward to doing that work along with the two representatives and other interested legislators on this. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for comments. Any questions from our committee? Okay. Thank you for introducing this bill to us today. We'll be talking about it more. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have a number of people signed up to speak today, and I'd like to commend our representatives for starting off by having such concise statements. And I'd appreciate it if folks can be concise. And we don't have a time limit today, but I do have high hopes of getting everybody who wants to speak through both this bill and subsequent bills. At this time, I'd like to invite a panel of three up: Jason Miner, Jonathan Manton, and Marianne Nash. Marianne, I hope I got your name right.
Yes, thank you.
I'll go right ahead whenever you're ready.
Vice Chair Helm and members of the committee, thanks so much for having us here today to testify in support of HB 2633. For the record, my name is Jason Miner. I'm the Executive Director of 1000 Friends of Oregon. 1000 Friends of Oregon is a nonprofit membership organization that works with Oregonians to protect farms and forests, promote livable urban and rural communities, and provide transportation and housing choice. Many of the goals you heard reflected in the DLCD presentation earlier today.
Jason, can I ask you to move back from the microphone a little bit? We're all getting used to this. They're very sensitive. They're much better than what we're used to in other forums.
Any more difficult questions? I think the answer is yes, but I will try.
Thank you.
As Representative Leininger mentioned, this is an important bill, and I do want to highlight the way that we came to this bill was in reflection on the massive earthquake and tsunami in the Pacific Ocean that in Japan unfortunately claimed over 15,000 lives and led to over $300 billion in damage, and the fact that that actually had a ripple effect in hitting Brookings with the tsunami as well, and there was damage to property and people in southern Oregon, one of the first tsunamis to hit the Oregon coast in quite some time. As well, it was referenced the expense that the state has invested in fighting forest fires, over $70 million as an extra appropriation for forest firefighting in southern Oregon. And lastly, much of the coverage following the Oso landslide reflected on how that landslide happened in a known landslide zone, an area that simple aerial photography could demonstrate was subject to landslides. And I often heard repeated the refrain, simple planning could have prevented this. While the timing of a natural disaster is impossible to predict, local governments can minimize the toll by acting thoughtfully when planning for the future and planning for future growth. And I think HB 2633 very much seeks to accomplish this. Carrie McLaren, representing the department, mentioned the goals established 40 years ago, and I would highlight that I think in her summarization of the various sections of goals and bundling them in different patterns, what stood out is goal 7, I don't believe, fell in any specific bundle. It's a very rational goal, though, planning for natural hazards and planning to limit development in areas subject to natural hazards. It has never been implemented, and this means that there are no enforceable requirements to determine whether local governments plan for natural hazards or that guide them in how to treat natural hazards when they are planning for future growth. I'd say that the benefits of implementing Goal 7 through this legislation are we can look to save lives by reducing the number of structures and hazard areas in the long term. We can look to save money by reducing the costs associated with structures and hazard areas, whether that's firefighting, rebuilding costs, or other costs. We can look to institute planning flexibility by allowing local governments to correct decisions that do not look so good in retrospect at this point. So I would just echo another thing that I heard in earlier testimony. This bill is necessary to fully implement Goal 7 and fully implement the suite of goals that were envisioned in the Land Use Planning Program. It is complementary to other programs and to budget requests that are ongoing at this time. And for those reasons, I ask that you consider supporting HB 2633. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Helm. Members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Manton on behalf of Central Oregon Land Watch. It's very nice to be with you here today. I'll try to be very, very brief. I understand you have a full agenda. Central Oregon Land Watch was organized back in the 1980s and has operated for over 25 years in Central Oregon, working to protect neighborhoods and encourage conservation of both private and public lands. Our mission is to achieve a balanced and integrated approach to land use planning in Central Oregon that will safeguard our natural resources and foster socially and economically thriving communities. I want to talk to you today just very briefly about the wildfire situation in Central Oregon, and mention a couple of quotes from the 2010 Deschutes County Natural Hazards Mitigation Plan. We very much support this legislation, and I think these quotes speak for themselves. On page 40 of that plan, it says, "The recent explosion in population has led to increased residential development into forested land and in the wildland-urban interface." Page 43 is, "Large wildland interfires in Deschutes County are escalating in size and are having an increasing impact on the citizens, values at risk, and infrastructure of the county." The significant story here is that Central Oregon has experienced high-intensity wildland fires on 48% more acreage in the last decade than in the previous 100 years combined. Between 2000 and 2009, 188,450 acres burned. And that doesn't account, obviously, just this past summer, we had the Twin Bulls wildfire, which was garnered a lot of media attention and forced some people to evacuate. And so with that, I just want to say that we very much support this idea that we need to do a better job of planning for these natural hazards, and appreciate your leadership and all the work that you've done thus far this session to get bring your level of expertise to this committee, and look forward to seeing you with a gavel in your hand more than just today, hopefully.
I didn't pay him to say that.
Vice Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, and I am the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau is Oregon's largest grassroots agricultural organization, representing 8,000 member families. And we support natural disaster planning, and our looking forward to working with everyone on this bill. Our concern is crafting an appropriate agricultural exemption, because a lot of the lands that our members operate on are zoned EFU, don't have significant development, would maybe have an old barn or some type of structure located in a floodplain, and we don't want our members to have to undergo significant costs that they can't afford associated with these structures if they get pulled into a disaster planning process. So for the reason that these are kind of sparsely populated and very sparsely constructed areas, we are asking for some form of agricultural exemption for land zoned EFU.
Very good. Thank you very much. Committee questions for our panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate
Thank you.
It. I'm sorry, I'm the next panel, Dave Honeycutt and Sean Clark?
Cleef.
Sorry, I couldn't quite read that. And if Peggy Lynch is available, Peggy, if I could have you come up on this panel too.
You want me to go first?
They'll be thrilled.
Welcome, and go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, you go ahead.
Oh,
after you, sir.
Oh, all right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking here in opposition to 2633, not to the concept. I think the concept is valid, but to the language of the bill itself. The bill, as drafted, has some very broad, undefined terms, the key term being hazard areas. And under the language of the bill, when you combine it with the whereas clauses, we're talking, the bill has the potential to affect and impact every area of the state, from wildfire forest land areas, which represent 8 million acres of the state, to rangeland, which essentially is Harney County, Malheur County, Baker County, Grant County, you name it, Eastern Oregon, to areas of intermittent heavy rain events and floods and landslides, which is the coast and the valley, to coastal erosion and flooding. Well, that's the coast. Tsunami areas, that's the coast. Earthquake areas, that's Portland, Hillsborough, Gresham, all of those areas. All of those could be potentially hazard areas as defined by this bill, or by actually by the lack of definition in this bill. And when you combine the potential breadth of the language of the bill with the guts of the bill, which you can find in Section 1, Sub 2, it's lines 1 through 6 on page 2 of the bill, what the bill directs is for the department to establish regulations that either limit development policies in those hazard areas, require retrofitting of structures in those hazard areas, or and C seems to me to be the most onerous one, removal or relocation of structures and facilities that are at a substantial risk of harm from natural hazards when the risk cannot be mitigated adequately. Well, there's a number of phrases and in the guts of that bill that are both unclear and potentially tremendously damaging. I can't imagine being a property owner in the Pearl District in downtown Portland and finding out that I have to remove my structure because I'm in an earthquake hazard zone, or being farmer and Mrs. Jones with 40 acres of pucker brush out in the middle of Harney County, being told that I'm now at risk of a rangeland fire and I have to remove my dwelling. The bill, the intentions of the bill, I think, are good. The language of the bill, I think, is dangerous, and especially when you consider that given the requirements of the bill, I'm not sure that DLCD is the proper agency to do that. I was on the task force in 97 or 99, I think that Mr. Whitman mentioned, where we dealt with landslide hazards in forest zones. That was a very contentious OFIC bill that we all worked on and ended up with a deal. The agencies in charge of the landslide hazard legislation was not DLCD, it was DOGAMI and Department of Forestry. When you're talking about things like determining where hazard areas are, you're into DOGAMI and OEM territory, not DLCD territory. When you're talking about retrofitting structures, again, that's not a planning exercise, it's a building code exercise, and I don't think DLCD is the right agency to be making that call. And it's the same when you're talking about removal of structures. The task force that Representative Boone and Representative Leininger and Representative Widener have been on is a fine task force, and maybe a group that ought to be in charge of determining where these hazard areas are, or maybe we let that go to the local government, or maybe we find an agency that's tasked with that. I just don't think DLCD is the proper agency to do that. And given the breadth of this bill and the direction to the agency, I think the policy is right, but the branch that they've chosen to hang the policy on is wrong. So I'd be happy to sit down and work with the sponsors on fixing this if they're amenable to doing so and getting the policy that I think everyone intended.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I won't belabor the committee by repeating everything that Mr. Honeycutt so eloquently said. I will add that Mr. Gomberg, Representative Leininger, and Senator Dembrough had a meeting with the governor's staff and the Association of Realtors and the Home Builders yesterday, I believe it was, where we had discussed opportunities to clarify the language in the bill and get to the intent of the concept rather than dealing with some of the pitfalls that Mr. Honeycutt had spelled out.
Okay. Thank you.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. And we all talk about land use planning as if it's this weird thing, but land use planning is about where people live, where they work, where they play, where they shop, and how they get there. And so it's a really important part, and I love the slide that DLCD provided that shows land use planning and all of the circles around, because it does affect everything. The League has positions on our statewide land use planning program. We also have positions on hazards and seismic risks. And these two positions together come together when we consider how to protect Oregonians from increasing threat of floods, landslides, and other natural hazards. We support the concept of 2633 because we believe it's important for the state to help in the responsibility of public safety of our citizens. We know that we're seeing more landslides, we're seeing more floods, we're seeing more a variety of natural hazards much more quickly, and we need to find a way to address it. Respectfully, Dave Honeycutt mentioned that page two, line two, talks about establishing a program. It says provide guidance. It doesn't say specifically they have to do these kinds of things. It says that this agency shall take the leadership on this discussion. During the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, we had a multiple group of agencies that worked together to come up with that strategy. I guess I see that this bill provides that opportunity for one agency to be the lead agency while others work together to solve this issue. We have testified before LCDC a number of times to support actions that they have already begun to do. They've taken some limited steps to assist in jurisdictions relocating schools. Vernonia is a great example. And in providing storage units to help to assist coastal jurisdictions in having a place for supplies, for life-saving supplies in emergencies. So we see this as an extension of the work that they need to do. We also supported recently the Dogami budget that was mentioned because we believe that they have the scientific knowledge to be able to provide the data that we need to be able to know which places are most hazardous and how we might resolve those issues. And then lastly, I just want to say on a personal note, I lived between Eugene and Florence on the coast in my growing up years. And in 1962, we had the Columbus Day storm. We were stuck in our home for over a week as the landslides needed to be cleared on Highway 36. And again, the same occurred in 64 with the 64 floods. Those are just two examples of the same kind of story I think I heard earlier. So I would recommend that you move forward with this bill. Yes, there may need to be some amendments to work on it, but the concept is there, and it's a really important public safety bill. So I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none. Thank you very much for your testimony. May I please invite up at this time Eric Chancellor and Aaron Doyle. And then our final panel will be Stephen Kafori and Ed Johnston. After that, I think we have time for me to invite anybody that didn't get a chance to sign up but wants to. And I do appreciate the concise testimony. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Helm. Members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. Eric asked that I go first. I don't know why. As stated previously, the League represents all 242 cities. And when we did our policy committee, our priority process, one of the things that was pretty prevalent in our discussions was the Oregon Resilience Plan and the need for natural hazard mitigation and planning and needing for technical assistance with that. So I'm pleased to see the concepts behind House Bill 2633. I am also concerned with some of the specific language because we handle more than just planning as cities. We also do some building codes and inspections and things like that, and we know that each of our departments has a particular set of expertise, and we would like, and the state has similar programs and expertise, and we would like to have those who are providing the guidance to local governments to be those who are the experts in the field. For example, about restructuring or removing structures with building codes and building inspectors being the experts in that. We would like to see maybe not DLCD being in charge of running that program. However, the other piece that we'd like to consider beyond just needing to set some clearer regulations through rulemaking to enact Goal 7 would be finding out what departments know what and coordinating between them so that we're not having DLCD try and do science when we have Dogami to do science, but having DLCD help coordinate that science so that our local governments can effectively respond to the hazards that are highly likely in their area first and then less likely, and then the asteroid. We also would like technical assistance, and while I know you are not the Ways and Means Committee, we would like to put in support for those POPs that would help with that technical assistance from the department. They have recently taken over the state's natural hazard mitigation plan and are assisting counties and cities in developing their local natural hazard mitigation plans, which can help us do our emergency management and get some access to funds from FEMA if a disaster should strike. And we want to continue that work and make sure that any rules that might be created around Goal 7 would take that into consideration. We're excited to help determine the best ways for local governments to do the planning that they need to prevent folks from being stuck in their house for a year or a week or a day if a disaster should strike. And we know that each set of our communities is going to face a big issue. Should it be the big one? Should it be the floods or landslides or a windstorm that tears up a community? So we're excited to help and hope to see some of the amendments address some of the technical concerns about the language of the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
All right. Thank you, Vice Chair Helm, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Chancellor, and I'm here representing the city of Bend. I'd like to say that I think Aaron I almost called you on. Aaron put it very well. The League does an excellent job of representing the interests of the city. So we've submitted written testimony. I'll keep my oral testimony incredibly short. We have basically three concerns. One that you've heard already, in that the bill really lacks a lot of specificity. If we're going to have a rulemaking process, it would make sense from our perspectives to have a more robust dialogue, perhaps within this committee, perhaps side conversations, to determine quite precisely what it is we want to do by rule. Second, also, it's been made by Aaron. The point has been made by Aaron and others that quite a bit of effort has already been expended through various agencies and various efforts. There's no need to recreate the wheel. It certainly should be a very organized, very integrated effort. Lastly, I think we need to, and again, you're not the Ways and Means Committee, but as you consider this bill and knowing that it would have to go to the Ways and Means Committee, it seems to us that $50,000 is probably not enough money to truly devote to this. If the agency is tasked, if any agency is tasked with doing this work, whether it's DLCD or otherwise, we want to make sure that the cost associated with doing that is fully expected, fully reflected in the budget. Otherwise, it's going to come at the expense of other priorities. Local governments obviously implement the state land use system. And would hope to be a part of any conversation about moving this bill forward so we could lend our perspective. The City of Bend, I know, would be happy to participate in any discussions going forward. Thank you for your time.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions from the committee for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming today. And our last panel today will be Stephen Kikori and Ed Johnson.
All right. Gentlemen, speak first.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kifori. I'm here representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. This represents the state's land use planners, the land use lawyers, and citizen members of planning commissions around the state. Could say ditto to Eric's comments. Basically, we, as everyone has said, agree with the basic thrust of the bill. We do have some specific concerns. We're concerned how the new administrative rules and programs will coordinate with existing comprehensive plan goal 7 elements and natural hazard mitigation plans. We want to know how would data that's existing already on natural hazard risks would be incorporated into local comprehensive plans and natural hazard mitigation plans. How will the state avoid the implementation issues it experienced with the rollout of Senate Bill 12 in 1999 related to rapidly moving landscapes? How will the hazards be inventoried? State agents are presently working on upgrading hazard data. How will this be incorporated? We agree with Mr. Kantler that $50,000 doesn't begin to be enough to do what this requires, and it's better to go in and say, here's much of it's going to cost, and pay what it's going to cost. We think that also extends to local governments. We do have a state law that says that if the state legislature requires local governments to expend money because of statutes that we pass, that we have to pay for those. And it looks to me like what we're doing here is putting an unfunded mandate on local government. We'd like to work with the committee to, as everyone else says, to work on making this a better bill and one that will actually work. Thank you. Oh, one other thing I want to add. We did add, this is in your books, in your committee books, but I also sent in this morning a white paper called Resiliency, a Holistic Approach. It's about a 10-page paper that was produced by the Oregon chapter having to do with natural hazard planning and suggesting a more holistic approach to thinking about planning for this area. Thank you.
Very good. We'll find that and make sure it ends up in the committee meeting minutes. Mr. Johnson.
Yes. My given name is Edward Johnston. Basically, when it comes down to it, I'm against the entire structure of this because I look at it as being a pirate fraud game. This is original document that I have published in the papers in Oregon. This is
the Queen's stamp on a declaration of our Constitution, the law of the land. This is on my, I have the treaty with the British government called Democracy on my website, Oregon Trackers. I want my land deregulated out of this system by law. Law, not statutes and codes. There is a difference of law. Law is the supreme law of the land. This is the supreme law of the land. I want my land deregulated. As I have filed in Lincoln County for my land to be deregulated, I have had numerous attempts, assassination attempts on me by public servants, and I would like to thank and respect those who have honored their oath of office, and including the oath to the Treaty of 1213. Please read it, the Pope. What disturbs me is, as my senator,
Mr. Chairman,
I like to speak before I get interrupted.
Chairman, may I?
You'll yield. Representative Witt.
The charge of attempted assassination by elected public officials is a serious one.
That's right, it is, and I have it. And I, let me finish.
Johnson.
Put the evidence in, please.
Representative Witt, would you like to follow up?
Mr. Chairman, unless there is some kind of documented evidence.
Yes, there is.
I would prefer that witnesses not throw out casual accusations on very serious charges.
That is correct, sir. And you are right, Representative Witt. It has been published. I have filed the documents with it. I have emailed each and every senator and state rep with it. 2006, when the Inspector General's report stated clearly that the public servants in Lincoln County by the Department of Justice stated it in the reports. Okay? This is what I've been fighting since. I've been trying to get unregulated. I'm a subsistence hunter and fisherman, and I'm turning all this evidence into this record. Okay? So this way it is not an accusation. I have tried to talk to Mr. Goomberg on it, as Senator Arnie Roebling's office has stated to me. Sue him. Which is disturbing because our public servants take a constitutional oath to this instrument to protect Americans. I am not a foreign agent. I am not an immigrant. My family's been here for more than 200 years. Okay? And by the statutes and codes, what I'm putting this instrument in, which I've emailed all of you this information, and yes, Representative Whip, I do take it seriously when I get my, when I'm pulled over at gunpoint and told with the videos that are on YouTube with the police chief of the city of Toledo telling me if I don't pay these fines and circumstances, what's going to happen to me. I have the YouTube video with the public pretender that tells me that if I am, what we have on YouTube in the conversation, that if I'm murdered, it's called homicide by legalese. The state attorney general's office, Runeberg, sent me a letter stating that they cannot deal with legalese, even though it's a crime.
Mr.
And I have
Chairman.
That in writing that I have sent to you men.
Mr.
Okay?
Mr. Johnson, I'm gonna make a request of you right now, and if you can't abide by it, I'm gonna ask you to step down.
Yes.
Okay. If you have specific statements about the specifics of this bill, we are happy to hear about it. Your generalized comments of protest are completely irrelevant to this bill.
If you
have specific comments about this bill, we will hear of them. If not, I'd ask you to wrap up for today.
Okay, like I said, I will be turning all this into evidence, including our rights to travel without a license on land use, because we do have a lawful right. It's called recreational vehicle use to travel in the state of Oregon without a license. Okay, we do have rights. Lawful Americans have rights, not privileges. When we get talked into registering our land in the state, it becomes a registered privilege instead of a landowner. Okay, I want to get some of these things straightened out because I'm very disturbed and threatened. When I've purchased my land, I have the right to own my land by our treaties and contracts, not to lease it. This bill is going in and stating and changing land use and structure to make it a privilege, so that way we become quotations citizens and we're renting our land as a privilege. And we have a right to own our land completely outright and with not being incumbents. And I would like to see this committee let the residents, the inhabitants, let me correct my statements. There's a lawful and legal difference, inhabitants and residents. But as an inhabitant, we have a right to own our land, not be infringed on, not be trespassed, not to breach the peace on it, like I've had, and I've got the videos.
Mr. Johnson, I've asked you three times now to be specific.
I understand.
And I'm now going to ask you to step down.
I'm going to turn in this stuff to you, evidence for record.
You're more than welcome
and
to.
And so that way there is not a conflict of interest, okay? And like I said, I would like to have my land be regulated out of your system, and lawfully I can do that, and I would like the assistance from the chair and vice chair to do that. Thank you very much. Peace and God bless Jesus. And mainly, read the Treaty of 1213. That's what we're fighting right now. It's in this instrument.
Thank you. For our committee, any questions of either Mr. Kefouri or Mr. Johnston?
Thank you
both. Is there any person in the audience that would like to speak? Please come up. And please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
You may have a seat.
Is it necessary for me to sit? I would prefer to stand, thank you. This is not a common thing for me to be here and listen to all of these things, although I find myself utterly mesmerized at all the programs and agendas that are at hand. Thank you so much for being here and helping to establish a better life for all Oregonians. I am greatly concerned at the lack of empty spaces, the lack of the people who I think there should be by far more people here, because these are important initiatives. And I think that a lot of these initiatives also should be placed back on the responsibility, the self-education, the self-determination, and self-discipline of the people who live here in Oregon. I think that it would be a very good thing if the state would take some of these programs and utilize them to educate the people who are not hearing these things, who are not part of understanding what is happening. I think that this is one of the greatest conundrums, is that the public at large, the public in large, the people who are the true people and not persons, are unknowledgeable. And I would like to see an initiative from all state representatives to help to educate the people as to why these initiatives are on board and are being looked at. Because what my understanding at this point is that there are many agencies who are trying to handle and deal with these issues. However, they're a small group compared to the populace of Oregon, and they are basing their agendas and ideas on not only facts, but opinions of very few. And I do not have the solutions with how to bring about the knowledge to the people, but I know that collectively, all of you state representatives can find the solution to wake the people up. I would also like to address, in regard to these land use developments and initiatives, I think that it is time that the state has a very definitive, broad spectrum look at the contracts that have been utilized for, I don't know how long, but a very long time, with all the land barons who are withholding the land from the people and their rights to travel freely across the land. Because when I grew up, there weren't fences. Weyerhaeuser did not have a conglomerate priority to keep the land away from the people for their benefit for timber. And I think that these contracts need to be looked at and opened up and inspected for a different contract to be utilized. And that's what I'd like to say.
Thank you for your testimony today. If you could give us your name for our record before you leave, that's one of the conventions that we follow here.
Thank you. My name is Jeanette Marie, surname Pengraff.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, audience.
Okay. We at this time are going to move to the next item on the public hearing agenda. And that's an item that I'm actually going to move forward a little bit so that we can accommodate a participant that is calling in by phone. So thank you all for your comments on HB 2633. But for folks that were following this, I wanted to add one comment before we leave this bill. And we're talking about the scope of a bill that implements a statewide planning goal. A touchstone for me as an appellate attorney is to always go back to the purpose statements that authorize the work. And those purpose statements are set forth in the very first section of Statewide Planning Goal 7. It's easy to find on the website. It's subsections 1 and 2. And it does address all the things that the bill is talking about so far. Easy to find. I think we can all read it in our spare time. So thank you for that. So at this time, we'll continue the public hearing with HB 2719, and we'll be getting Mr. Mike Dewey on the phone so he can participate. Mr. Dewey, this is Vice Chair Ken Helm from the Rural Communities Land Use and Water Committee. Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. We're moving this bill up to this time to make sure we get your testimony today. And so I'm going to put you first in line of those that want to testify. So whenever you're ready, go right ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mike Dewey on behalf of Portland Meadows. Thank you for accommodating my situation. I can assure you I'm not on the golf course by any means. This is, in my 42 years of lobbying, the first time that I've spoken to a committee by phone, and I apologize. I know it's a little clunky to do this, but I didn't really have any choice today. At the outset, let me just let you know that with regard to the horse racing industry in Oregon, based on a recent study from Econ Northwest, an economic analysis of the racing industry, it is a 100 million plus industry per year in Oregon. Today we are discussing, again somewhat clunky, but I'll read to you the multi-jurisdictional simulcasting and interactive wagering totalizator hubs, which I will now refer to as wagering hubs. Let me give you a little brief history. In 1997, late in the session, I had the pleasure of having a client, Multnomah Greyhound Park. And at the time, the owner of the Greyhound Park was Hubbard Enterprises, a gentleman by the name of Mark Wilson, who was vice president of Hubbard Enterprise and chief counsel, came to me with an idea, and he was formerly chief counsel of Churchill Downs. And it became really an incredible idea in the sense that he surmised over time all pari-mutuel wagering on horses and greyhounds would migrate to the internet, which it has, and other forms of wagering have been facilitated now through the internet. And you have what we now call, in the technological terms, data centers or data servers that facilitate these wagering hubs. So we devised this long name, and we just kind of made it up on the fly in terms of looking for legislation to amend into a bill, which is now ORS 462725. So we passed legislation in 1975. The governor approved the legislation, and guess what? Because Oregon was the first state to license and regulate the wagering hubs, these hubs came to Oregon, and they are now regulated by the Oregon Racing Commission. Now, some of you may know this, others may not. Before the voters approved the enactment of the Oregon lottery, which after that, because of the video slot machine approval in Oregon for the lottery, that got the casinos, which are now prevalent in Oregon. Before all of that, the only legal form of gaming in Oregon was horse racing and greyhound racing. And obviously the lottery and the casinos over time have had an adverse effect on the racing industry. So what we did in 97 is we found the bill, we drafted an amendment, and were able to have it placed in the committee and House committee very late in the session, which set up the wagering hub regulation and licensure. And as a part of the structure, for every wager that is transacted through an Oregon wagering hub, there's a surcharge by statute that is placed on their hubs. And the Racing Commission is, I believe, before you today, and they can talk about the technical nature, who the various hubs are, the amount of money that's wagered, but it's a huge amount of dollars that flow through the data centers and the servers. And this is why you now have these massive pools, for example, at Churchill Downs at the Kentucky Derby, because individuals can wager at the track. They can wager on a race that is being run around the world somewhere else at another track or on their devices through various applications. So individuals can set up individual accounts and wager through these various hubs. For example, Churchill Downs has one of the hubs that's located in Wood. What we had envisioned, if this were to pass and the hubs were to come to petition, that we could have some set of money that would be allocated from the Racing Commission to the county fair race meets, to purses, to the owners of the horses in Oregon, to Oregon bred horses, Portland Meadows, the racetrack, and perhaps other requirements through the administrative rule. So it's been very, very successful. And at the time, quite frankly, on something that didn't exist, we thought it was probably a good idea to figure out what was the revenue share from the surcharge. And we, quite frankly, we had this discussion a couple years ago in another committee. We just kind of said, okay, why don't we have 66 2/3% of the revenue go to the Racing Commission, and 33 1/3% go to the state of Oregon, which is essentially the general. And if we were successful, this would be a statute that would be on the books without any revenue, without any regulations. And we are fortunate that these hubs did come to Oregon, and they continue to remain in Oregon. And most of those, I understand, are in Washington County and the Beaverton area. So we have a pot of money that has been set aside for racing, and I'll talk about the fiscal impact in a minute. But also want you to know that these wagering hubs also pay for their own regulation. In the statute, there's a requirement that they pay a license fee of not more than $200 per operating day. So that's for the oversight, basically the integrity of ensuring that the wagering is done properly and there's nothing that is skewed with regard to the operation of these hubs. And they are audited on a regular basis by the Racing Commission. They have auditors to do that. So they said this revenue benefits the racing industry in Oregon. The amount of money that is projected to be raised from the surcharge, according to the Racing Commission, through 2015 and 17 is $4.2 million. And the bill that you have before you has a split now of recommended split, 15% to the state of Oregon and 85% to the Racing Commission, then would be allocated through a process to the various tracks, versus and the like, which I described. This is another way to help the racing industry. There are others that are going to speak to this bill. We do urge your support. We may have an amendment on the effective date in terms of where the hubs operate and how they operate. But we're going to be looking at that because I understand this is a voluntary move. So, Mr. Chair, I will stop. I know you have others that want to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions, or I can wait until a later time during this hearing.
No, I'm eager for the others.
Again, thank you so much for the opportunity in accommodating my situation.
Thank you, Mr. Dewey. We do have a couple of folks signed up. Linnell Smith, please come forward, and Nick Lowe. Mr. Dewey, did you want to stay in the line and listen, or?
Yeah, I'll just stay in the line and listen if it's not a problem for the staff.
Okay. So I'll just welcome our other folks testifying and beg your indulgence that we do. I'm trying to get to two other bills after this and get.
Yeah, I've got a birdie putt here, so I'll just.
So again, if you can be as concise as possible, I'd be very appreciative. Go right ahead when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm and members of the committee. My name is Nick Lowe, spelled L-O-W-E. I serve on a board of the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent Protective Association, also referred to as OHBPA. We are a nonprofit organization made up of over 800 owners and trainers of thoroughbred horses in the state of Oregon. The racing industry in the state of Oregon is a $200 billion industry, and it is struggling because of the other gaming. And we would strongly support House Bill 2719. Thank you.
Thank you. That was concise for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm, representatives. I'm Linnell Fox Smith. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association. The OTOBA's mission is to promote the owning, breeding, and racing of Oregon-bred thoroughbreds. Our programs support racing at Portland Meadows and five county fairs. Our owners and breeders reside in 85% of the counties across Oregon. They provide jobs and they support their local economies. Next month at our annual awards banquet, we will be celebrating 70 years of Oregon-bred champions. That's pretty amazing, don't you think? Unfortunately, the thoroughbred breeding industry in Oregon is on the verge of disaster. This is the annual Oregon Registered Foal Crop Report from the Jockey Club. Quite simply, the Jockey Club keeps track of all thoroughbreds born and registered in Oregon. And although this is the 2015 report, their official numbers are only stated through 2012. You can see, however, there has been a steady decline in the number of thoroughbreds born and registered in the state since the early 2000s. I was able to obtain the unofficial numbers for 2013 and 2014. They aren't any better. In 2013, the unofficial number of thoroughbreds born and registered in Oregon was 63. And last year, the unofficial number was 62. 62 foals. If we're lucky, maybe half of those will come to the track for training 2 years from now. If their owners are very lucky, maybe half of them will win a race during their career. There is no magic solution to save the Oregon thoroughbred breeding industry. It will take a concerted effort from the entire racing community to ensure that the Oregon-bred thoroughbred survives. On behalf of our board of directors, our owners, and our breeders, we respectfully request that you pass House Bill 2719 so that more funds will remain within the industry and can help save the Oregon thoroughbred. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Dave Nelson. I live at 7479 Nelson Lane, Turner, Oregon. I represented Portland Meadows here at the legislature from 1976 to 2006 and was very involved with Mr. Dewey in the development of the off-track wagering programs and the interactive wagering systems. During that period of time, we saw the legislature adopt video poker games in 1991. That introduced Indian gaming casinos because of screen game as a screen game.
we had poker games, and that was a card game, and that became a blackjack game, and so the foundation for casinos was laid throughout the state. What happened was that during the 10-year period from 1991 to 2000, the number of screens that were available for gaming went from zero to over 12,000. The racing handle, which is the amount of money wagered on races throughout the state, that's Portland Meadows, the Multnomah Greyhound Track, and at the time there was six or seven county fair meets. They're now down to five county fair meets. The handle dropped from $120 million annually down to $63 million annually. So this effort was an effort to, and as Mr. Dewey can tell you, in 1995 we were successful in passing legislation that gave the racetracks, both racetracks, Multnomah Kennel Club and Portland Meadows, 75 video poker machines to compete or to mitigate the effect of having had 4,500 machines placed in Multnomah and Clackamas County right around the racetracks. So it was. This was passed in the late 1990s. Mr. Dewey, I think, said 1997. I think that's correct. As an opportunity for the racing industry to make a little additional money off of its own product to mitigate the effect of other legalized state gaming that that was all around it. So we would strongly urge that you send this on down to Ways and Means, and we can argue the dollars there, see what can be done. And I think the percentages are relatively mild changes in the percentage or in the distribution of the money. So any questions, I would be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Gilley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. I have a question for Ms. Is it Fox Smith?
Yes.
Before that, I just wanted to compliment Mr. Nelson. You didn't seem to be nervous at all about this process. You just
when I retired, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilliam, I added 10 years to my life expectancy.
Well, we're glad to see you back. Back to my question. It's not so much about the revenue from gambling, which racetrack betting, which is extremely important here. I'm concerned and stunned by what you said about how breeders and breeding in Oregon is atrophying. Obviously, the fiscal on there, I mean, sending this to Ways and Means and the revenue part is important. But can you be a little more specific about what we can do, both as a state and as breeders,
sure,
to bring this industry back?
Sure.
It's a wonderful industry and well worth seeing.
Right. Thank you, Representative. Actually, if you go back to that chart, the Jockey Club, you see that in 1997 we hit a peak of 358 thoroughbreds. That is directly attributed to a grant we received in 1994. The OTOBA received $150,000 from the State Agricultural Redevelopment Fund. We paid it all out in Breeders' Awards and Stallion Awards, and our numbers jumped significantly within 3 years. Just an infusion of money in any way helps breeders. To get that foal that's born to the track in 2 years will cost that breeder and owner almost $20,000. If the horse gets there, if it's sound, if it even wants to be a racehorse. So they've expended all of that money before they even have a chance to make anything back. So any little bit helps. We have proposed some breeding programs. We've presented that to the Oregon Racing Commission for funding. And this bill, passage of this bill, would just help those funds be available so that the commission can allocate them to the best interest of the paramutual industry and certainly to help save Oregon breeding.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your presentations today. Just so that folks know, including Mr. Dewey, I'm sure this will be pushed forward to a work session in the near future. Chair Clem, of course, is gone today, may be gone next Tuesday as well. So we'll get him back in the loop when we hear about this again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye. In the final 5 minutes today, I think that we'll go ahead and try to fit in a public hearing on HB
2456. Is there anybody here to speak on that? Okay. Mr. Rindy.
Thank you, Vice Chair Helm and members, member of the committee. I'll be very brief on 2456. This is simply a correction of an error to some legislation, very significant legislation from the 2013 session. And in the interest of time, and I know it's short today, I'm not going to, unless you wish, I'm not going to go into a lot of the details about what happened here, but suffice it to say that in this very complex package of legislation, which was changed in several times and was a product of a lot of different minds, in some way there was a drafting error. I'll refer you to page 3 of the bill. You look at 919 and you'll see that it refers back to a subsection 3C. That subsection, you can actually see it's crossed out on line 20 of page 2. It really made no sense to do that. We discovered in trying to figure that out that a section of text had been omitted from the draft. This statute was drafted in two parts, one for small cities and one for large cities, and that's very fortunate because it does show us exactly what was missing since they were intended to be identical. And this bill simply inserts that missing section. This legislation really doesn't take effect until 2016, January 1, so there's plenty of time to fix it, and that's what this bill is about.
Great. Very good. Let me have you. I'm assuming that you may be testifying on the next bill, too, if I can fit it in.
Yes, you may.
Okay. Mr. Kafuri, you are signed up to testify, I think, on both of these bills, so...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Stephen Kafuri, representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. I'll be very brief and just say that my association supports both bills, and you have written testimony, which I provided to the committee.
Very good.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both for your testimony. And let's, since it's just myself, we'll go ahead and have the public testimony on HB 2457 at this time, too, and we'll get them all in the hopper, and we can move them all forward.
Thank you, and I apologize, Mr. Chair. I actually have some written testimony that I will hand out to you. And Mr. Honeycutt, 2457 is a very simple bill, and many cities. We don't actually have the number, but I think it's many, and especially the Portland metro area. The urban growth boundary has in various places has been placed to follow a natural feature, such as a stream corridor. Unfortunately, what that means over time is that since most of the lands, many of the lands at the edge, certainly in the valley, are farmland, is that eventually there becomes an opportunity for a city to annex that property. And if that property is partly outside the urban growth boundary and partly inside, the problem that has come to our attention is that occasionally that property that is that part of the parcel that's outside the urban growth boundary can't be divided from the part that's inside because there's a statutory minimum lot size for farm and forest land. And so, for example, if you had a parcel that where that statute minimum is 80 acres and the parcel, let's say, is 100 acres, if 50 acres of that is inside the urban growth boundary, that division can't be accomplished because the remainder outside would be too small. Cities are having trouble annexing this land as a result, and they're certainly having trouble partitioning in order to allow higher density zoning for the part in the UGB. So in the interest of time, I will stop here and just say what this bill does is authorize that kind of land division. It allows for that situation only, a smaller minimum lot size for farm and forest land. And it makes sure that the parcel that is divided that remains outside the new parcel, outside the urban growth boundary, is planned and zoned appropriately for farm and forest use and remains that way. That's the broad details, and I'd be happy to answer questions if they come up.
Thank you. I don't have any at this time. Mr. Honeycutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Indians in Action. I agree with the concept that Mr. Rindy and the department has proposed. I talked with Mr. Rindy and Ms. McLaren outside before the public hearing. There may be, and I'm afraid that there may be a couple of drafting errors in the bill that I think we can fix either through an amendment or through some legislative history that don't affect the concept of the bill. I think Ledge Council tried to clean up some existing language, and it may have unintended consequences, but it has nothing to do with the merits of the bill. So whether that's through an amendment or through legislative history, that's the reason I'm up here. I like the bill and support the concept.
Okay, very good. I imagine that we may have sufficient time for any amendments that you could agree on to be submitted before we get back to the work session on this.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we didn't find out about this till today, but we will certainly convene a small discussion that includes legislative council, and if we can find a solution that involves a simple fix with legislative history, we'd certainly pursue that, and if need be, we'll make amendments. We don't have an opinion at this point on whether these errors are there, but we certainly would want to fix them if they are.
Okay, very good. Thank you for both for being here and getting us through our agenda today. Okay. Thanks to everybody that came today. This hearing's closed.